On last week's The Space Show, we were at the Deakin Edge, which is in Federation Square. We were at a meeting of the Moon Village Association and a panel discussion on the lunar environment and, setting up a moon village. Now, Kerry Doherty is a space historian and former curator at Sydney's Powerhouse, and she had asked this question in last week's program, and we only got partway through the answer to her question. So let's go with the question once more.
But I'd like you all to comment on this, that before the Apollo 8 image, there was another image of the Earth that was taken by one of the lunar orbiter spacecraft. So this is a robotic spacecraft, and it took a picture of the Earth, and that was the very first, but it was only black and white. Now, do we somehow contextualise our environment when we see it in colour, but not in black and white? You know, is there something about that image that couldn't grab us in the way that those colour images from Apollo could? So I think that's part of, that broader cultural context of the moon.
Okay, hello. I'm Dr. Evie Kendall, and I have the privilege of moderating this panel with a number of experts in the field of environment. I'm going to give the names and the affiliations of each of our experts just first. We have Dr. Yasmina Lazendich-Galloway from Monash University. Now I'm going to introduce the next speaker in order, so that's Dr. Helen Brand from Australia's Synchrotron. Excellent. Next, Dr. Alice Gorman from Flinders University. Okay, and finally we have Cara Wiseman from the Office of the Victorian Government Architect.
Planetary geology, colour, as we've said, colour means something, same as in astronomy, and it can completely alter your perspective of the geological landform. So in the really early black and white photos, I remember the professor who ran the group that I was in doing my PhD, he was the world expert in the eruptions of Mount Etna. And so when the first photos of the moon were taken, he had a mate in America who rang him up, who was helping NASA, and he said, they can't tell if they're volcanoes or impact craters on the moon. They've got all these round things. Can you come and have a look? So they flew him over. He took one look at them and said, it's not a volcano. And then he showed them how to take, and then they started taking stereo images. And then they started to see the relief, and they started to see the different bits of how the images were in context, and it all fit into place. But until he sort of came over and said, no, look at it this way, they didn't see it at all. So I think there's something there as well, maybe.
My first response was similar to Alice's in that at that time it's all within the context of how people would have watched a black and white film but still overlaid their own experience of how that actually is for them in colour over that. But then that the blue of that other famous image that I showed before has another layer of how you just understand where you are and how that can start to then place you in the broader context of how you think about everything else. Yeah.
It was interesting when Helen has her formation of the moon slide. I don't know if you noticed, but Earth was like it is today, but that was proto-Earth, so it didn't have clouds and continents and stuff. But if you had to show a picture like that of proto-Earth, people would think it's Mars or something like that. So you almost sometimes have to put inaccuracies so that you don't build misconceptions, but then you have to just emphasize that that's not how Earth was then. So it's tricky to be able to convey some of these information. If you want to be scientifically completely correct, it's almost impossible to convey it just with a picture.
And in fact, quite a lot of the images for that slide that I found, as well as having Earth looking like Earth in that first picture, they had the impactor looking like Mars, because everyone describes it as a Mars-sized object. And I'm like, I almost didn't say when I was talking earlier, Mars-sized object, because I've had people ask me, oh, Mars hit the Earth? No.
Another example I just remembered is when I show students for the first time the sun with a, just continuum. and they're all excited. They're going to see the sun, and they go, I can't see the sun. There's this giant orange ball in a way. And I said, that's the sun. But they go, but where's all the fire and all the thing? I said, well, we have to put different filter to see this. This is just continuum. It's just orange ball, and if you're lucky, we see some sunspots. So it's, again, the daily feeling of the sun is a giant fireball that's burning, and they want to see something burning, but they just see this flat orange disk. Once you work in a particular field, some of those things become natural to you, but it's always like seeing from other people's eyes for the first time, you remember how actually it's not very intuitive. So,
well, the sun feels like it's burning us today.
Yes.
And I just wanted to add to Kara's brilliant point about how we place ourselves, and the colour blue is so important to that. So we've got our water and our sky, and we do see ourselves as living on a very blue planet. So the whole pale blue dot, the fragility of our planet, and when you see it from that scale, is something that astronauts have described being very profound, that experience, that overview effect. Okay, we have time for one more question, so where are we? Do we already have the mic there?
You've shown how when Europeans came to Melbourne, they changed the environment, chopped down all the trees and so on. People in Europe would not have been able to see that because it's around the other side of the Earth. If mining takes place on the Moon and large-scale changes to the albedo is made by stirring up the regolith, people from Earth will be able to see that. Do you think that that will engender some protest from the people on Earth that the albedo of the Moon is being changed?
I guess that comes back to the value that's placed on what's there and then what the change means. And whether, you know, so that change, changing the landscape here was seen as a progress that was worthwhile because it meant settlement was possible for one group of people. And the loss of a lot of other things wasn't considered as important as that. So
you would have to cover a huge surface of the Moon with darker colour to change albedo. So whatever you build on the Moon would have to be light colour because you don't want to absorb more sunlight. So I don't think anything that is planned to be built or mined could actually change albedo that much. So we will still have beautiful full moon and it's not practical. Because if we do that, that's going to be more energy inefficient than blending in with the environment.
But I think this is really interesting because, yes, we're not going to necessarily see new dark patches appear on the Moon, but there are people watching the Moon. Like, there's an incredibly strong amateur astronomy photography community around the world. They're photographing the Moon all the time. So, and I actually think this is, so we will see, they post their pictures on social media, so, and some of them are incredibly talented photographers, so they're going to be making available to us pictures of what people are doing on the Moon that we can see, and I think that's great, because that's a way of us actually monitoring that whoever's operating on the Moon is abiding by whatever conditions are set at time. And I have a vision of having a community satellite, maybe crowd-funded like some lunar missions are, that will be for the people of the Earth to be able to monitor all industrial and human activities on the Moon. So we're not reliant on them conveying this information to us. Private corporations, for example, are not accountable to the public. So they don't have to tell us what they're doing there. But if we can see that, we have a way through that amateur photography community, maybe through a citizen satellite, we can have a way of calling people to account for whatever they do to that environment. So I think there's lots of interesting potential for people to get involved at this level and analysing that data as well. So, because this is going to change the Moon we think we know, even if we can't see it, I reckon.
Okay, I'm going to cut that off because we have time for one more question. So I'm going to ask the lady just there, just behind you, who had her hand up before. And we'll finish on your question. Thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, does environmental ethics extend beyond life and biology? Because as far as we know, there's not life on the moon. So should we care about approaching sort of lifeless rocks sensitively? Which kind of touches on what Jasmina said about sending all of the tourists to the moon. And can we assume terra nullius on the moon? It's a bit of a loaded term, but kind of relevant in terms of it being void of occupation and life.
Who wants to start with this one?
That's actually a question for you.
Well, I didn't plant this question in the audience, let me stress. However, my interest in space ethics, of course, includes questions like, does the moon have any rights? We want to go to the moon, but what do we have to offer the moon in exchange for that? So do we have obligations not to mine in an unsustainable manner? And if so, are those obligations to other people on our planet because of that connection that we have with the moon? Or is it because the moon itself has some inherent right to exist and to be preserved in a particular way? So the preservation of the lunar landscape, of course, also things like how do we guarantee that it's still available for future generations? We all do share that connection with the moon. Do you want to follow up with any other points?
Oh, I just want to say, for me, it's but being environmentally mindful is not about that place itself necessarily, but about who we want to be. But space, by default, will have to be environmentally friendly because we cannot be... We can't make... The resources will be scarce and we can't... We have to recycle everything. We have to carefully reuse everything. We have to think before we act because if we drill for 5 days somewhere and it's waste of time and energy, you know, we might die next 5 days. So... That's one reason I like space exploration so much and building space bases, even if they're not permanent, even if you just go and do scientific exploration or just tourist run, to see how you can, to imagine how well you can live. We are so, so disrespectful of how we treat Earth. I mean, just daily, just looking around, I you know, as older I get, I just want to go... You know, slapping everybody in the head, saying, "Do you know what consequences you of you just dropping that there on the floor? You know, some fish will die. You know, in 10 years because of that." So, I mean, you know, so I'm in the generation that was born into, yeah, let's use whatever. To now, you know, going, no, I know consequences of this. The beads that we use in exfoliators are now, you know, killing fish and changing. So everything is a system. It's a dynamical system. But because we don't see it on our daily life, you know, we get sort of, we see polar bears starving for one day and we feel horrible and then we forget about it because the next Netflix show is out and we have to watch it. But if you experience living in space for a week, I mean, we have Mars analog stations where people go for 2 weeks and they come reborn. And if we can send everybody, one of the astronauts said, every politician should be launched in space to see what Earth means. They will change their way, how they treat Earth and how they make policies. So this is where I think the power of space is. And as I said, by default, you would have to be environmentally savvy anywhere you go because you just can't afford to lose any material.
Okay, very quickly, final comments from anyone else?
I think you're spot on with the terra nullius comparison. And I'm a huge fan of the work of the radical feminist eco-philosopher Val Plumwood, who conceives of environments as sort of agents in their own right, but also sort of co-dependent collaborators. And I think that's a really useful way of conceiving how we might go forward in our interaction with space environments.
Anything to add? Not mandatory. Okay, please join me in thanking our panel.